Edward Hirsch has authored 9 poetry collections and several prose books, including A Poet's Glossary and How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. We talked about these works in part one of this conversation while he was at Rockhurst University's 2016 Midwest Poet Series. The second half begins with a poem later included in his book of New and Selected, The Living Fire. When he wrote Boy with a Headset, Hirsch had no idea that a few years later he'd be writing a book-length elegy for the subject, his son, Gabriel.
He's wearing baggy shorts and a loud t-shirt and singing along to his headset on Broadway. Every now and then he glances back at me, a middle-aged father weaving through traffic behind him. He's a 15-year-old in the city, no more, no less. But I imagine him as a colorful, unnamed bird, warbling his difference from the robins and sparrows and scissoring past the vendors on every corner. I keep thinking of him as a wild fledgling who tilts precariously on one wing and peers back at me from the sudden height before sailing out over the treetops.
Boy with a Headset, which was originally in the collection Special Orders, published in 2008 by Edward Hirsch, and is now part of his new and selected poems, The Living Fire. This is New Letters on the Air, and I'm Angela Elam. Let's talk a little bit about Gabriel, because Gabriel was your only child, adopted, and died very early at 22 years old. And I have to say that Gabriel, the book about him, took my breath away reading it. It's one long poem, and it's written, I actually used your poet's glossary for this because I was thinking, now what's the difference between a triplet and a tercet?
Those terms are loosely used now. At one time, triplets meant 3 rhyming lines.
A tercet doesn't have to be rhymed. It can be unrhymed too.
These are 3-line stanzas, but they don't rhyme and they're unpunctuated.
I love this one that you say, he loved cartoons where nothing is final. Everyone gets flattened and then gets up and starts running around again. And I thought, boy, that captures him, you know, later.
It's actually accurate for...
I was thinking how you tackle some of the most painful parts of your life and turn them into poetry. But Gabriel, I find really amazing in how you had the strength to sit down and write this story and show us all sides of Gabriel. I mean, there are moments in here where you want to reach out and choke him.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, really.
it can be difficult.
And then other times where he was just so incredibly lovable and you captured that. I mean, how did you do it? Did you sit down and write from beginning to end? I mean, how did you even approach this?
Gabriel died when he was 22 in a very sudden way. And after he died, I was in complete shock, as you would be. And I was just beside myself, really. I was just overcome by grief. And I took a leave from my job for about 6 months. And I went down to Atlanta to live with my partner because I just couldn't function. And for about a year, I stopped doing any poetry events. I just really couldn't do anything. But when I was down in Atlanta, I still had to figure out then when I was there what to do every day. And so I decided to write a prose document documenting Gabriel's life, basically, for myself. It was all a blur. And so I began to talk to my ex-wife. I talked to my sisters. I talked to my girlfriend. I talked to Gabriel's friends. And suddenly it became desperately important to me to try and figure out what had happened because we'd had such a rocky road. All the schools, all the medications.
We should say that he had...
He had all kinds of challenges.
Yeah.
We never had a good diagnosis. His diagnosis was pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. But yes, he had a lot of challenges. And I'd written very little about Gabriel. I mean, I wrote the poem Boy with a Headset, but I'd written very little about Gabriel while he was alive. But suddenly, not for publication, but just to get the story straight for myself, to try and make some sense of it, I spent a lot of time making this document, and I wrote a little biography of Gabriel. And I showed it to my partner, and she said, I don't know really at the end, I'm not sure what you're asking me, but it's not a book, because what you've done is you've told Gabriel's story, but you've left yourself completely out of it. It's just facts. So I had that in my mind. And then I went back to work, but I still wasn't doing any poetry events. And I began to see that now I had the facts straight. Now maybe I could try and make some poems out of it. And I began with one thing that's actually in the book, which was something that always puzzled me, which is I took Gabriel to a fireworks display once. I had him on my shoulders. And he said, "I don't know, Dad, I didn't come here to see the fireworks." Well, I never understood what you were. It was a fireworks display, and so I don't quite understand what you were. This seems so funny and weird to me.
Why don't we start with that one, since that was the impetus to do this?
So there's a pun in the poem you're asking me to read about sun, S-U-N and S-O-N, which I originally got from John Donne, who makes the same pun. But in his case, it's a Christian analogy, the Son of God. But in my case, it's my actual son. I was trying to describe the sensation you get as a parent of the last time you carry your child on your shoulders. Because for a long time, you do that all the time, and then you don't do it anymore. The son is tired, and so I'm hoisting him up and carrying him on my shoulders over the hill or through the park, around the pond, back to the car, home from the ball game. He's scrambling up my back, his bare legs tightening around my neck. I'm grasping his ankles, giving him a seat in the grandstands just above my head. The son wants to see the stage over the crowd and look down upon the world. He's bounding onto my shoulders in the swimming pool and diving off. I can still feel his slippery feet. Why is he so scalding hot on my shoulders? I'm lifting him over my back and striding through the woods like a tree walking with an orb branching out of its trunk. He's perched atop my ladder at the fireworks display, but he's restless and wants to bolt. I didn't come here to watch the fireworks.
That's from Gabriel, a poem by Edward Hirsch, and you're listening to him today here on New Letters on the Air.
I was trying to get into the poem the feeling of what it was like as a father to be carrying your boy on your shoulders in many different times. There are just a lot of daily experiences there that seem to me worth trying to write about. So I began to try and make some anecdotes, and then it became unbearable to me. The idea of writing some poems about Gabriel, like Boy with a Headset, for some reason, I just couldn't stand it. I'd written many elegies before, like my poems for Dennis. I'd written many poems about my father. I didn't have a problem with having these elegies be in a book with other people and other subjects. It just seemed that's the nature of what a diverse collection is. But what had happened was so momentous and so overwhelming that I began to feel that it was just unbearable to just tell some anecdotes about Gabriel. And so I began to think through, could I do it? Could I actually tell the whole story as I understood it in a poem? That I wasn't a memoirist, but I was a poet. And could I write a poem that would get through what I felt? It's a father's book. I wouldn't pretend to be telling Gabriel's story from his point of view, or from his mother's point of view, or from his friend's point of view, but I would tell it from my point of view as a father. But I would also try to capture what Gabriel was like. There really isn't anything much in American poetry that's really about a character, that really gives you what a person is like in all his complexity. That's really been the task of novelists. I wonder if I could do this in poetry. And I hit upon the idea of writing poems that are unpunctuated, and that I could shape it in three-line stanzas, and that I could put 10 three-line stanzas to a section, and so the poem would be in individual sections. But it would also be one poem, and the individual sections would be, I call them near poems. They're not fully formed individual poems, but they're close. Each one runs through a kind of rhetorical strategy. It has a kind of idea. And that in this way, I would be able to move and shift and do a couple of things. One, I would tell my story as a father, and I would express my grief as a father. But I would also tell Gabriel's story. And the book begins with Gabriel's death. It's not a secret what happens. Not how he dies at the beginning, but it begins and ends in the funeral home. I didn't want it to be a mystery. I wanted people to know right from the beginning, this is an elegy. But then it does settle in and begin to tell Gabriel's story from the time we adopted him to his death. And he is captured, I think. The thing that I like most about the book is much of it is funny, because Gabriel's funny and a lot of his antics are crazy, but they are funny. And I was able to get that down. And then it does come back to what happened and how he died. And we're back in the funeral home again.
I love some of the stories you tell about him. I mean, we really do start from the very beginning when you flew to New Orleans and picked him up. And were you in Italy when you flew there?
I won the Prix de Rome, and we were spending a year in Italy at the American Academy in Rome. But we were also going through the adoption process at the same time. I was living in Houston. I was teaching the creative writing program at the University of Houston. I was in my late 30s. But my wife and I were going through the adoption process.
There's an early poem by you that's also in The Living Fire that's included in that called Infertility. And it gives some insight, I think.
That's the beginning. That's the years of infertility before we could have a child. And then we decided to adopt a child. And we were living in Rome. And so Gabriel begins his journey. We fly from Rome to New Orleans and pick him up, and then he comes back to Rome with us.
Bouncing back to The Living Fire, you opened up this book with a very interesting short piece called The Beginning of Poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Could you read that? It's very short.
The Beginning of Poetry. Railroad tracks split the campus in half. And at night you'd lie on your narrow cot and listen to the lonely whistle of a train crossing the prairie in the dark.
That opens The Living Fire by Edward Hirsch. Can you talk a little bit about what you were doing there?
I got the idea that I'd write a short poem about where poetry started for me. And I just lived with the idea for a while. I went to a small school in Iowa, Grinnell College. And literally, there was railroad tracks that went through the campus. And I remember lying in my dorm room and hearing the sound of a train at night. And you know that feeling you get when you hear a train on the prairie?
It's lonesome.
It's so lonely and piercing and beautiful. And I just kept thinking back to that moment. And then I got the idea, let's call that the beginning of poetry. That is, it begins in that pre-linguistic feeling, before language, where you're alone and you feel some deep solitude, something inside yourself. And then you hear this piercing whistle that somehow articulates your loneliness in the prairie. And that maybe poetry originates in this feeling rather than in words. And that poetry then has to find a language, but it's pre-verbal. That was the premise of the poem. And it would have a landscape, and the landscape's the Midwest.
Well, I kind of got the same sort of feeling from a passage out of Gabriel, a poem, and it's very much a city scene. But there was something here about this physical thing in the world that, well, let's hear you read it and then talk a little bit about metaphors.
I stood at the damaged site across the street from my house and watched a steel ball crashing into the homeless shelter abandoned on Dean Street, all the people scattered. It takes tremendous force to weaken a building and turn bricks into rubble. It doesn't take long. The crane swung around and pitched the heavy ball into the guts of the structure, holding its side like a wounded veteran. The hard hats gathered to watch the pendulum swing into the concrete body of a building slated for demolition so there could be progress. I was against the project and riveted to the wreckage. Time and again, the fighter wavered and finally collapsed. I did not stay to see the building broken down into debris and then carted away. Some nights I could not tell if he was the wrecking ball or the building it crashed into.
Edward Hirsch today here on New Letters on the Air. And the he there is, of course, Gabriel.
He is Gabriel.
Right.
So most of this poem is not about Gabriel. The nine stanzas are about standing in front of a site that's about to be demolished. It's a city scene. You're standing on the street. We've all seen it. And you watching with a kind of quotidian horror, daily horror, as this wrecking ball starts damaging the building, and then the building collapses. And all of that is just a literal description in a somewhat detailed way of watching this happen. And it was happening near my house, and I had been against this project right from the beginning. It was a huge development in Brooklyn. And I thought I was writing about that. And for nine stanzas, I was. And then in the last stanza, maybe this is what you're getting at, the whole thing becomes a metaphor for what Gabriel was like. Because he himself is so out of control, so impulsive. This is very late in the book, and you know a lot about Gabriel now and about his experiences. So at this point you go, is Gabriel just destroying everything himself? Or is he actually the victim? Is he the building that's being crashed into? And the poem doesn't answer that question. It leaves me wondering which is the case.
Yeah, that's what I thought was so magical about it. It was really at the heart of what poetry can do, you know, when you have a metaphor like that, who will make you see something in a different way.
And that just can't be planned. I was writing Gabriel, but at this particular section, I was really trying to describe the damage. But something in me was thinking through something emotional at the same time. And by staying with the scene as long as I did, it eventually yielded itself to what I think the emotional meaning was. It both gives you the description of what's happening on the street, but it also belongs in this book because it has a kind of metaphorical significance.
Well, that's one of the things I was wondering about. When you started this piece, I mean, did you know it was going to be part of Gabriel?
I was in the process of writing the book Gabriel, not in the order that it is now, but I was writing this book. But I can't say that when I started writing about this building being destroyed across the street from my house, that I knew where it was going to lead or how it would be about Gabriel. I didn't. But I was at that point trusting the process. And I was writing in three-line stanzas without punctuation the same way I was writing the rest of the book. Now, I should say I wrote many, many more sections than are in this book. So sometimes they didn't click, sometimes they carried extra information, sometimes it was too much. Not all of them fit in the book. But I was just trusting the process. And I just thought, well, if it doesn't fit, it doesn't fit, but I'm going to see where it leads. And in this case, it really was an instrument of discovery. It led me to something that I'd been clearly thinking about in an unconscious way about Gabriel, but it has a real concrete life by describing something in the city.
Right. Well, that's what makes a poem exciting, I think. You feel like there's a discovery that you make as you go through it. I love that part of it.
I should say that one of the things I had to decide about a long poem about Gabriel was whether I could do it. Not just technically, but whether I had the emotional fortitude to do it. Was I going to put myself in situations that were uncomfortable and to say things that were unpleasant? And you cannot write a poem about the loss of a child that's sentimental, which you have every right to be, God knows, but you shouldn't write poetry. And I had to decide, could I write a poem that wasn't sentimental? And was I tough enough to do it? And did I have the courage to do it? And I decided to make a try. It was very emotionally challenging for many reasons, but that was one of them. Would you be willing to write about yourself and about your son and about experiences that would be very difficult to render?
Yeah.
That's the reason I decided I could write the book, because it's my book and I'm not pretending to be anyone else, but it is a father's grief and it is a father's story, but I am telling Gabriel's stories entrusted to me, but it's through my eyes.
You know, one of the things that you also do in this book that you do so often in your work is you go back to a lot of these writers in the past who have lost children and pull in details about that into the work itself so that we can learn from that too. I love that.
This is one of the other odder features of the book, that I was writing Gabriel's story, but I became aware that I had to find a way to think through the problem that the suffering that I was writing about was real, but I'm not the only one that this ever happened to. I'm not the only parent who lost a child.
Or had to deal with the kinds of disabilities that
exactly.
he had.
Or aside from death, or who dealt with, we're a lot of special schools and a lot of people with children who have all kinds of special challenges. I'm far from being the only one to have gone through this, even if there is a kind of taboo about talking about it. The question is how to let people know that and how to think through that. And so what I did was called on my people. I began to think about the poems I knew of poets who had lost children, also maybe poets as parents, and the conflict that poets had many times expressed between being a writer and being a parent and what that's like. And I began to write some sections in the same shape and the same form about these other poets. And it gave me a way to reflect on my own experience in a way that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And it's a powerful, I would say, sub-motif in the book, these other poems, these other poets,
and how they've
handled it. It creates a kind of chorus.
That's a good way to describe it.
I think it's a kind of chorus of other poets who've lost children. It's not such a flattering portrait of poets as parents.
Well, I want to have you read the section that comes from his best friend, because that was such a wonderful touch and so needed at this point in the book.
Gabriel's friend, Joe, is the speaker of these two sections. Gabe was my best friend. Gabe was my right-hand man. Gabe was my wingman. I could tell you a lot of stories. I wrote them down. We did everything together. I think I'll drop it and tell you what it felt like to be with Gabe on his 22nd birthday. We went to a tattoo parlor to watch an Ultimate Fighting match on pay-per-view. We pulled $400 and betted on the underdog, Cain Velasquez. Gabe said his head looks like a brick. We needed him to beat the UFC heavyweight champ, Brock Lesnar, the baddest man on the planet. I once saw him pulverize a guy. I was nervous because everyone was shouting about the killer in the octagon and everything was on the line. But Gabe just gave me that little smirk of his, you know the one I mean. It said, "We got this." That night we won big. We won really big. We pocketed $800. We danced on the tables while others drank themselves under them. We painted the town red. We bounced over to a club downtown. It was so crowded no one was getting in, but Gabe convinced the doorman we were part of the wedding party, just like in the movie Wedding Crashers. It was an after party for a Chinese wedding. Gabe kept telling everyone we were distant relatives of the bride and groom. We were just wearing our regular clothes, jeans and t-shirts. But Gabe was insistent. He had a baby face. People wanted to believe him, even when they knew he was lying. But once we got inside the party, the Chinese girls could barely speak English, and so we couldn't talk to them. We picked up Peppy, too, at the end of the night. We jumped on the backs of some monster garbage trucks to hitch a ride. The garbage men chased after us with baseball bats, but they were too fat to catch us. I can still hear them wheezing after us. We ended up at Union Square at dawn. Gabe headed off with his last $40. "Where are you going?" I told him. "That's your last cash. Why don't you save some of it for tomorrow?" But he said, "We've just had the night of our lives, and these homeless guys deserve a good breakfast." He bought 2 pies and 24 donuts and handed them out to the homeless men in Union Square.
That is so great. That's from Gabriel, a poem, the 2014 book by Edward Hirsch. There was something about having these two kids, 22 years old, and it was so lighthearted in a way and gave you some insight into Gabe's generosity. Because like I said, there are some places in here where you do want to strangle him.
He was tremendously challenging and compelling. My ex-wife and I were just stunned by this story. We had no idea.
Yeah.
You know, they don't tell you anything. This was the night of his 22nd birthday.
How long after his birthday did he die? Because he died when he was 22.
Not so long after.
Yeah.
This was Gabriel's friend's eulogy.
It's a found poem.
It's a found poem. It was a tremendous relief to everyone because you feel the joy of it.
Yes,
you feel what it means to be 22. You feel the weird antics of them, what they were doing. I think the reason you feel better is it's sort of the night of their lives and the joy in it and the recklessness of it and the feeling of being young. And also, it's not my point of view. It's Gabriel's friend, Joe. I showed it to him before I published it and before it was in the book to make sure that he thought it was right. And he was amazed. He thought it was exactly accurate to what he'd said. He made one small correction, which is I had said that he had said Gabriel had a baby face. People believed him. And he said, well, actually, it's a little more complicated than that. He said, what I actually said was Gabriel had a baby face. People wanted to believe him even when they knew he was lying, which is a more complicated thought, actually, a funnier and more interesting thing.
Definitely.
And so I worked it into the form. But I'm really grateful to Gabriel's friend for articulating this and giving us some happiness and some joy about their antics. And you feel the antics of these kids together, what they were doing.
Yeah. Besides the joy, there's a sense, even though it was craziness that they were doing, there was a sense of normalcy here.
And then there's just the generosity at the end where he actually feels something for these homeless guys.
Well, I'm going to get you to end with one more from Gabriel. And it starts with, I did not know the work of mourning.
This is a very important section to me because this is the recognition that we're talking about, that yes, this happened to me, but I'm not the only one this has happened to. So many people are walking around with this grief, and you don't know it because you don't know them. But you get to be a certain age, and everyone is carrying something around. And the recognition of this was very important to me in the poem. I mean, I began by just writing about carrying a bag of cement that you can't see and the feeling of what that's like, where you feel as if something's on your shoulders, but you don't know what it is. And it's your grief. And it's the brutality of, like, every day going through this process. And then I think, to me, the thing that makes it a poem, really, is the not only the connection to Sisyphus, but the recognition that almost everyone is carrying this around. It's only because it's invisible and you don't see it and you don't know them. And that it actually, the ordinary things that we're doing, when you've been through these kinds of devastation, it takes courage to continue.
Yeah, you can't always see people's bags of cement.
Exactly. They're almost invisible, but almost everyone is carrying them.
Yeah.
And when I finally came up with this metaphor, I felt I was actually close to having a book because I had found a way to include other people in my grief. I did not know the work of mourning is like carrying a bag of cement up a mountain at night. The mountaintop is not in sight because there is no mountaintop. Poor Sisyphus grief. I did not know I would struggle through a ragged underbrush without an upward path because there is no path. There's only a blunt rock with a river to fall into and time with its medieval chambers, time with its jagged edges and blunt instruments. I did not know the work of mourning is a labor in the dark we carry inside ourselves, though sometimes when I sleep, I'm with him again, and then I wake. Poor Sisyphus grief. I am not ready for your heaviness cemented to my body. Look closely, and you will see almost everyone carrying bags of cement on their shoulders. That's why it takes courage to get out of bed in the morning and climb into the day.
Edward Hirsch and his book, Gabriel, a Poem, winner of the National Jewish Book Award. To hear the first part of this interview with the former MacArthur genius at the 2016 Midwest Poet Series, go to newletters.org, a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Today's show was produced with Megan Schwindler, Danny Moran, Blake Elizondo, Mackenzie Callahan, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.